with you. I'm with you on that in a weird way, because I, you know.
That's different. Then people can always be engaged, right? At every level of understanding, there's always this engagement. It's part of what I want to talk about today, in terms of how to go about this. I wish Gaiman were here, though, because part of the last part I wanted to address to Gaiman, since he's looking at laboratory practices. So
That's kind of my. Yeah. That's why I was asking, because the stuff I'm going to talk about is a little, in a way, more in his direction, at least some of it.
Probably also addressing you too, because I was thinking about, well, do we know, does anybody have this? I don't have his number. Does anybody have his number? Adam would, but
I
don't.
No, I think.
Do you think
I have his contact?
His
number. I think I have his number, yeah.
I'll wait a minute while for Mike to get back.
Let's see here.
Because that is, some water.
Did we play for lunch?
Yeah, then we didn't have a place in mind.
We did a place in mind?
I have his number. You want me to forward it to you?
Sure. All right, well.
Or you want me to text him or call him? Or?
You can just text him. Maybe can you text him?
Yeah.
Just to say that, you know, ask him what his plans are.
That would be really invigorating and, you know, good for the group.
Specifically for my project, it would be a way for you to triage between the artists and some of the stuff.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, once I finish this book, the next thing I'm going to be working on is actually a big art installation project.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're talking about
this experimental forest, you know, project. So,
so that would be the other side. I don't have to be a part of that conversation.
Okay. And you did I was looking at the Google Docs spreadsheet, and that's a pretty nice list.
Maybe with, half.
You know, there's a lot of people on the list.
Yeah, half the whole.
It's more than
half
of that. It's more like criteria rather than. It's more like how do we?
I mean, the other thing I was. And I guess everybody should be here, but we can talk about this. The other thing I was kind of thinking about, you know, in terms of having a kind of a little trial symposium for some of these people, you know, it was like, okay, would it be better, would it be more effective to maybe have that symposium to give it kind of a more focused theme or problem or question? Because, you know, we've just been sitting around kind of doing our thing, and that's been great, but I just wonder if at some point if we go to something that's got a little more...
So maybe tomorrow we do that.
I mean, if somebody invited me, like, and I was one of these people coming to this thing, and they said, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, ontogenesis beyond complexity. I'd be like, what the... You know, whereas, you know, if we... I mean, you know, so, I mean, it's just something to think about in terms of what would help... I think actually what would help the people we invite do a better job and feel like...
Do you want to talk about Nicholas and Helga?
Well, in the afternoon. In the afternoon, when we're all back together and Adam's back and...
right.
Maybe... well, we're going to have lunch.
We're having lunch.
So let's do that. For sure.
Yeah.
We can do it over lunch.
Yeah.
So, in fact, in the same spirit, okay, what I'm going to talk about is... I'll just say a few slides about one of two research streams that I thought would could be part of this ontogenesis initiative. The first one was on rhythm, but I won't talk about that today. The second one here is on textural care, which is much more speculative, which is why I want to try out with in safe audiences. I mean, friendly audiences, at least, if not safe. And then, but then I really want to spend more time talking about the how we're doing this kind of investigation. Yes, using art methods, but not to produce art, but using artistic methods, but also using philosophical methods. So, philosophical, in the spirit of a philosophical investigation. And finally, a few slides about, to open the conversation about how do we invite more people into this kind of thing. So the starting point was kind of a frustration over 15 years with identity politics, which I'm sure is shared with a lot of people. And because I was involved with probably some of you, with very much with this kind of politics back in the 90s, 80s, and 90s. And I don't regret any of that. I think it was very, very good, very, very empowering for the people who were in it. But the question was, even if all the Chinese Americans, all the Japanese Americans, Native Americans, African Americans, we all get what we want, right? I mean, we all get what we deserve, to put it that way. Why the hell should I care about you? You know, if you're not from my group, that's the problem of solidarity, right? So, and I don't believe that. Just right now, I'm talking with some friends like Stacy and other folks. For them, the tropes of intersectionality are not adequate, not thick enough for this kind of thing. Okay, I'm hearing some. Okay, good. So that's just a code for motivating some of what I want to do. So about a year and a half ago, I was invited to Vienna in a very different context to talk about. And that conference was for architects and urban planners. And the title of that conference was on the politics of care. Yeah, the publics or the politics of care. But it was formed by urban planners and architects. So I was invited because of the Topological Media book. I said, oh, okay, so try to speak to this audience. So since they used the word care, I used it as an opportunity to speculate a little bit beyond the book about the following conjecture about how to think about care and how to relate that to politics. And it goes like this. It's a sketch. Okay, the sketch is like this. If we use Deleuzean language in terms of, let's say, thinking about what physicists would call scalar fields, like the temperature in this room, or what I think of affective field as a scalar field, a field of intensity, so use Deleuzean language and physics language at the same time, then in every place in the multiplicity, there is some sort of intensity. That's like what physicists will call scalar field. If the field is differentiable, and if we have a notion of a differentiable operator, these are mathematical terms, then we can come up with a differential of that field, which gives us a vectorial field. This is Whiteheadian language. That is, it requires an action of differentiation that allows us to move from, to convert, let's say,
it's kind of field. If I've got some scalar field,
mm-hmm.
So to differentiate might be, for example, a Laplacian.
Yes, or any other differential operator, okay. Any combination. Okay. So, and this is a sketch, and it's also a model for a much more general situation. Okay. Anyway, then we get this idea of when we differentiate the scalar field, is what we get the vector field. The vector field is directed. This is what Whitehead was thinking about. It's about vectoriality of relations among entities. That's behind his notion. Okay, so it's very interesting. I mean, it's not drawn out of thin air. It's drawn out of these kinds of notions. What Whitehead did not do in his particular... Well, he did do, actually. He did have a notion of an action to grow that you could differentiate and get this kind of vectorial relationship. That's a technical comment. In any case, this, for me, is the beginning of politics. That is, it gives at least the very beginning. That is, because it gives a sense of a relation that's directed one to another. Okay. So that was what motivated this. This is, everybody's familiar with this. This is the spirit under which
I was beginning my talk is to think about this thoroughly processually, okay? And from the book itself, which is only slightly more elaborated, I tried to come up with, flesh out that what I just said in a few more steps, okay? And I will not talk about that much today. I'm not here to defend these things, this is very speculative. I'm more thinking about showing to you what we've done since then, in the last 4 or 5 years, to actually try to work with it. Oh, sure.
It's got the control.
It's out of control. Uh-huh. Can I do that? Okay. I could say something about it. Mm. No, it does, because it relates to mine. Okay, so let me do say something about it. Okay. The first proposition, and this is propositions in the sense of Stenger and Whitehead, they're not propositions in the sense of logic and mathematics. Okay, they don't have truth value, one is true or false. Mm-hmm. And they may not have proofs. Okay, they're arguments for why they might be interesting to entertain. All right, this is what mathematicians actually do, when we're actually making new kinds of mathematics. We're not scientists trying to make mathematics, you know, dig a description of the world. We're just playing with propositions and see what changes when we make change to the assumptions. Mm-hmm. And this is the sense in which mathematicians work. This is the sense in which Stenger said Whitehead was a mathematical philosopher. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's when we move propositional play. So the first proposition is that that ethics, I say that a continuum is necessary. A continuous substrate is a necessary condition for a possibility of ethics. And now after hearing my talk, then it'd be interesting to think about this in the domain of the potential. Okay? And we can talk about that, actually, I think very interestingly, in terms of the domain outside those causal cones, right? Outside those, within which this is where I think the domain of the ethical possibilities reside.
Yeah.
Actually there, you know, we can talk about that. But continuity, why continuity? This is more poetic, it's a poetic thought, which is the following. Speech, I mean, going back to the Greeks, right? I think that speech, wait, you're going back to the Greeks, it's a little Greek, is the quintessential medium of ethical comportment for me, all right? So that's why in the American law, you know, there are these fighting laws, fighting words, right? There are certain words you can be sued for as if you had hit somebody.
Yeah.
So this is kind of, for me, a residue of a much more ancient notion of speech as a medium of ethical relation, okay? This is just a little kind of a plug, okay? And another reason for this is because sound, which is a substrate for speech itself, is a co-oscillation of all matter, body, tissue, matter, sound, air, walls. It's very unlike light, because with vision, we have the law of excluded, not through the middle, but law of occlusion, mm-hmm. right? If I see you, I don't see the thing behind you. Whereas with sound, it permeates matter. So when I speak, my body co-resonates with your body. It's for that, so it's a kind of touch. Speech, oscillation, sound, co-permeation of matter by oscillation is a mode of touch. And for me, that's why speech, this is a poetic and physical poetry, so to speak. This is a flight of thought. This is why I think of speech as the medium of ethics. Because it mediates a mode of touch, okay? That's number one. Number two, this is why I think about fields from physics, because fields, we can talk about it, it's a structure, I'll talk about it in the diagram soon, it's a structure giving light, so to speak, to continua or manifolds of multiplicities, okay? It's not just a name of multiplicity, they actually give us a way, a language, a way to talk about valuations on top of a multiplicity that derived from multiplicity. So I already talked about number three, and that's it, okay. Right. I'm going to talk a little bit more now on why I'm interested in fields. From Simondon, the mode of existence of technical objects, he has a very nice passage. This is a way of thinking about potential, I think. But in Simondon's language, it's a very beautiful thing, so I'll just read it. Forms, oops, did come back. Forms interact not with forms, but with their background, the reservoir of the tendencies of all forms, even before they had separate existence, or constitute an explicit system. So it's been very inspiring to me as an external confirmation that maybe, yes, it would be interesting to think about all these phenomena in terms of fields. Okay, but thinking of the potential and the actual as actually before Mike, I didn't have the words, so I just said they were coincident. Okay, just coincident. So, okay. I had mathematics for it, but didn't have the ordinary language words for it. Yeah. Okay. So, now, how to pursue these kinds of investigations? Okay, so for many years, what I wanted to do was, yes, I could write essays and write books and argue these kinds of cases. I knew I would have some friends, you know, I can talk to maybe 5 or 20 people, I can say. But I really wanted to actually exemplify different worlds or world-making apparatuses so that people who come have no interest in philosophy could come and engage with these kinds of propositions. So that's what I've done over 15 years, okay? So, and now we can begin to expose this project, say it is actually a philosophical investigation in the mode of these kinds of palpable experiences. Okay, so some of those examples of palpable experiences is, terrible resolution. And some of you have seen this before. We carted 13 tons of sand into this black box. It's a beautiful, beautiful theatrical black box in Montreal. And there's a sign that should be south. And we threw, at some point, just, you know, yeah, you can hear it. Yeah. So as people throw sand, just, you know, for fun, you know, you hear this boom of sound, okay? And see the light also? Every single particle of sand that goes into the air is flows across the field of the camera. Then it's interpreted as an optical flow. That optical flow is then interpreted as parameters that then get sent back out to as video that gets shined on the floor. Okay, mm-hmm. So these are poetic, not logical. These are poetic transformations. Physical body movement is interpreted through mathematics into optical flow. Optical flow is then interpreted as light. Okay, and light is then shining on the bodies, which then makes the body's movement. Okay, so these are not merely, you know, logical and numerical, but they're poetic, transformations. Another example is this idea about just remember, behind those are all these notions of fields. They're always active in the work that we do. Okay, the work that we do is always based on field computations. Okay, continuous distributions of movement and matter. There's not a model of a human body with two arms and two legs. Or model, this is Xinhua, that's Mike, you know, character. We try to avoid those kinds of discretizations into tokens.
Okay. Surfaces are gradients.
Yes, also, as gradients, yeah. Okay, so I'll skip this part because it's off to talk about when we have time. Okay, now, texturality. So, in public talks, I begin to introduce the term texture instead of field. Why? Because when I say field, I sound like a mathematician or a physicist, right? It's okay, I can use the authority of physics and mathematics, but I actually don't want that authority. Because to me, it's a desiccating authority. It desiccates the world, desiccates ontology. And this is a danger I see with us in our group right now. Because we have people, 3 or 4 people who are very powerful scientists and mathematicians. Our language tends to dominate the conversation when we open our mouths and speak. Okay, when I say sheaf theory, when I say topology, you know, it's you see it has the power of R. And having been trained in mathematics, I'm very aware of the power are of mathematics, even more than physics in some ways. Mm-hmm. Because we can prove our statements, they're eternally true. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'll come back to that. I want to be very careful with the ethics under which I actually enact mathematics with you. Okay? So, okay, temporal texture. And also this way it challenges me and us to invent more mathematics. I can say, let's think about the texture of time. I spoke about it, I think 2 of us have seen the talk. I won't rehearse that whole talk. But that's why when I talk about time, I introduce the proposition that maybe we can think about temporality, the sense of time, not time, which is different from maybe Mike's project. Temporality, go right to the question of the sense of dynamic, change, rhythm. I don't say sense of time. I try to avoid saying sense of time. I don't want to make it topological. The sense of dynamic, change, you know, rhythm, let's say, passage. through this figure of texture, which then in the back I think, okay, well, I can put my field theory. You know? In this case, it's applied to the question of what gives one a sense of precarity, precariousness. So I skip that form. Okay. This one's different. This is an experiment on this notion about the following question. When we have a bunch of people doing stuff in a room, like cooking a dinner, someone's cooking, stirring a pot, somebody's on the phone, two kids are playing, you know, whatever, chess or something in the corner. When can we look at that scene and say, hey, those are correlated activities? When do we think, oh, that one person is not correlated in activity with the other people? When there's nothing similar in their motion. Okay, you might be doing very different motions. So it could be, it's not something you can say, well, this person lifted their hand with another person, you know, answered the phone at the same time. That could be one way, but it's too simple. I mean, that's one way. Or you can think about musicians, they're playing radically different instruments, maybe doing free jazz, right? And they're really playing different kinds of material, and then they all come to a halt at the same time, bang. And some ensembles are amazing. Some ensembles are really good at this. In fact, you can get better at this. So experience counts, practice counts, virtuosity counts. It's not random. This is the difference between random and total determinism. It says beautiful comes up. And so that's why we're interested in improvisatory activity. Mm. In this context, the question is, when is a set of activity, physical activity by bodies, construable as volitional? The second question is, when is a set of activity construable as joint activity? When are they correlated? So looking for statistically relevant measures, now we drop into a similar process in physics and all kind of thing, and computer stuff with sensors to try to construct an apparatus that we can use to explore the following proposition. The following proposition is, it's not so important like what shape the trajectory is. Here's what I want to look at. Correlation of time series, or time series are directions. That is, we put sensors on different bodies and it's normal to the body. For example, if I put it on my palm, it'd be like, you know, which way is the arm, the palm facing? Here, here, here. Or if I put it on my head, it's not so useful. It's mostly pointing up. If I go like this, then no one points this way. Okay, put it on the chest, it's a bit more useful. Okay, so basically this is the what's called the normal to a surface. We build a gear to measure normals to the surface, and then we take all that data in. We get the sense of directions. How is this interesting? Because if we go like this, everybody in the room will look to this point right here. We'll all turn our heads to this point. So that means we've all directed our attention to this flat at this place. So that's the way of correlating, right? But if a dancer moves like this and then moves toward here and, you know, puts a foot and bounces off like that, right? This becomes ground for this body at that moment in time. Mm. The dancer thinks in terms of gravity differently from the way that I think about gravity. For me, gravity is always the ground. For a dancer, no. For a dancer, ground is the surface against which she can exert maximum force at that moment. It's very interesting. Could be another body. Could be the door. Could be the floor.
You know what's interesting is that's a more correct sensibility.
Yeah.
That inertial mass and gravitational mass are actually the same thing.
Yep.
Dancer knows.
It is interesting. That's how they actually work. So we put this idea of direction into the picture. We measure the sequence of the series of correlations of directions from the bodies. You see, it's very beautiful actually. This idea. We barely begun. Okay. This is why we have a laboratory. This is one. Yeah.
What does that sound like? Is there sound?
Yeah, there was sound. It's actually done by a musician, a composer, who composed electronic music, and the sound is.
I'm just curious.
The sound is synthesized according to degree of chaos.
So each dancer has a gyro on them.
Okay. It's a degree of. I don't want to spend too much time on this.
I know, just a little bit.
But it's very pretty. Yeah. It is very pretty.
So
that when they decorrelate, when the one dancer decides to really exaggerate and think she goes to the floor, she goes just like this, so clearly she's uncorrelated as much as possible, you hear that the system begins to notice that, and it goes to noise. Not yet.
Is that a gamma one?
Huh?
Is that a gamma one?
Yeah. Well, he's synthesizing using gamma one style.
Yeah.
So she's trying to be really different, right? So.
There,
For us, when we say experiment, yes, partly it's scientific, but really it's more fundamentally, it's about reproducible conditioning of experience. So the analogy I often use is it's not about giving a person a percept, you know, like flashing a light and saying, person, lift your hand when you see it. That's kind of isolating the rest of the sensorium, you know, just blanking it out and only paying attention to this one thing. Instead, we're interested in thick experience and all its density, right? So yes, of course, it's a magic space, it's a theater space, not the world, okay? So it's intermediate between the wild world and a laboratory bench. Mm-hmm. But at least all the senses and all the faculties could be engaged, and we don't try to control for all that. Instead, we're interested in experimentally reconditioning or changing the condition. For example, we could build this floor on a rake, 5-degree rake. So when people walk across the floor, they feel a natural gradient. Then you can do anything you want. You can put furniture on it, you know, cook dinner, dance, you know, play around. It's like building a public space, right? How do we that's what architects think about all the time. That's what urban designers think about all the time. We're just doing it experimentally. We have less capital at stake, right? So that's what we've been doing for 15 years. Now, art methods. Yes, we condition the events paying attention to aesthetic effect as well as to other kinds of effects, you know, physical constraints, social conditioning, etc. Okay. And this takes a while when artists come into our group. They say, well, we are here not to make art, but to, we talked about this before, not to make works of art per se. We're here to actually think artistically, to achieve conditionings of events, paying attention to the affective, to the emotional, to the social, as well as to the aesthetic conditions, okay? As well as the logical, as well as the physics, right? So it's a very high bar. We're just beginning to get enough techniques that give us that kind of level of precision and yet openness to different modes of experience. I'll skip past these. There are many examples of this kind of work, but most of those examples that were well known in the art world are one-offs and don't get repeated very often. Okay?
What's that?
This is a work by Anish Kapoor. It was in Paris in the Grand Palais. An extraordinary work. It totally reconditioned experience, but you know, world famous artists, and you can't use this as a laboratory cook.
Yeah.
Okay. Beautiful work by Chiharu Shihota, who I just adored. Also, I think of this work as conditioning experience. This is her work was shown in the Venice Biennale.
Mm-hmm.
There are artists who do this, but they're working as very singular, extremely singular.
That's like sculpture, I saw.
These physical chairs and ordinary, real pianos, real chairs, and somebody went through and spun thread. She's, you know, stretched thread throughout the room. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
This is work by Yoshi Ikeda. It was done in the Armory, I think, in New York City a few years ago. Massive sound. Okay. So, experiment. What are the conditions for us for an experiment? People in the living in event at the same time, in the same place. So it's not about telematic stuff. Okay. We're thinking about live situations, which for the computer side means real time. So if you do something, something happens, just like this. And we'll skip over. So we did this. I'll skip through some things. Let's come back to a bit more theoretical concerns. Okay. So I wonder if I can start. So if Adam were here, or someone here, we can bore you. I mean, we can think about, in what sense we talk about Whitehead in play. It's thinking about for theorists, how can we think of some concepts such as sheaf theory or field as a lure for all of us to think. It's not a solution. I do not want to come and present you with whatever, you know, differential geometry, modern geometry, sheaf theory as the model, okay? Instead, I think same with Mike.
Because for yourself too, for my, to what you just said is interesting, because using all the elaborate apparatus is a mirror for yourself to think beyond physics. It's very interesting. The first time I heard that.
Oh my God, physics.
Here's an example, okay? I said this in the talk, remember?
Yeah.
Two ways to think about Newtonian object-oriented ontology, which would be two bodies, and this is mass one, and this is mass two. Compute the force, mg and 1 m2 over r squared, you compute the force, and you integrate that, right? That's one picture. But another picture is no second particle, just one particle. And because that particle has certain mass, let's say, and location, it perturbs the gravity field throughout space-time. Gravity is a field which permeates throughout space-time. Then, the second, any other particle is, if you were to put a particle somewhere, then it would feel such and such a force, and then it would move in such and such a way. So it's a potential. This field describes what would happen if, in that sense, it's potential. Okay? So I'm giving a much more elementary description behind what Mike just told us about 15 minutes ago. But this is so I would propose for scaffolding our future discussions to think in terms of these relatively elementary, from this point, elementary notions such as field to give us a scaffolding toward thinking about, for example, what Mike already said. In terms of sheaf theory. We'll get there. Because I think we need to build up bit by bit the vocabulary, such as what is an open set, what's a topology, you know, and then build the topological notion of field theory, which exists but only in a very technical language. What I want to do with the group here is develop a working vocabulary that does not over-determine the phenomena, that's open to the kinds of phenomena that let's say people from history or literature are going to come to us, which are going to exceed what the mathematics can describe. Okay, field theory. Longo was telling me about his work in Tufts University with Anna Soto and Carlos Sonnenschein. Very beautiful work, which I think would be transformative work for the field. Because as opposed to blaming the victim, the cell is of the wrong genotype, therefore it's going to be carcinogenic, it's becoming, there are certain kind of cancer someday. No, instead you think about it, a field effect. That the carcinogen attacks the stroma, which is below the skin level, disrupts the organization of tissues. Okay, disrupts the organization of tissues, and then as a result, the natural tendency of cells to proliferate, to multiply, will be released. Okay, so this is something that Longo has been working on as a consequence of some of his more theoretical work. Okay, so it'll be interesting. But this, for me, it's an example of field theory. It is explicitly called field theory. Okay. And now a little bit of vocabulary. Okay, so we talk about different kinds of boundaries. I just want to show how can you use the notion of surface and boundary in a philosophical way. I'm going to use pictures, but the point is a philosophical point, okay? And we've done this once before with Carrie and so this is a well-known phenomenon from physics, where you have a surface, let's say, electric field due to two charges, let's say minus one plus one, okay? And then the surface is going to be now to evolve, and the question is, how much flux goes through that surface? How much flux, okay? So you take all the field lines going through the surface, you do the surface integral, you add them up, you get a number. Turns out, let's say this is plus one charge, the surface integral will give you something proportional to plus one. So let's see what happens when we let the surface evolve. It's going to be plus one, plus one, plus one, if we had a thermometer on it. When the moment it contains the red, bang, the value goes to zero. And then it keeps on going until it leaves the blue, and then bang, goes to negative one. It's very interesting. This is, you have to believe me.
No, I don't understand.
This is a classic theorem called divergence theorem. This is how you can measure the flux, you can relate the charges in the world to the flux through a surface. This is classic E&M theory, electromagnetic theory, okay? And if you were to actually try to do this integral, you get those numbers that I just said, okay? It gives interesting discrete behavior from the surface as the flux, as it gets changes in shape. It contains different parts of the world. Okay, this is a physics phenomenon. Now I want to turn to philosophy, philosophical question, which is this: the picture, the story I just told you, okay, is given a field and given a surface, compute
the surface integral over that surface gives you a number, okay? There's another much more sophisticated way to think about this, which I think could be very useful from coming from geometric measure theory, which is think about this green thing, okay? It's kind of like a meter. And what is a meter? Well, it measures the flux of a field through its surface. Okay? Now I can vary the field, the black field, any black field, any force field. It doesn't have to be due to these two blue and red balls. Any set of charges gives me an electric field. It could be even a charge-free electric field around some pulsar, and then it gets a blobby thing out in the middle of space. Okay? So it's like a funny kind of photometer, you know, you try to measure the incidence of light through the photometer, the old style photometer to measure light coming through. That's what that does. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I'm changing the concept of the surface as an object into thinking of it as a meter of sorts. Something that is an operator that acts on a field to give me back a number. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is a very interesting one step of sophistication, because it turns a single object on a single field and takes that object, think of it as a number. Just another way. The number 5. Here it is. I look at the function f of 5, function being square, f of x equals x squared. For every number, it takes a square. So f of 5 is 25. Okay, here's another function, add 5, or add 7. So g takes a number, add 7 to it. So g of 5 gives me 7. So 5 stays the same. What I change is the function. So I can think of 5 not as a datum. I think of 5 as an operator. It acts on functions. So I just hit it with all sorts of functions. You know? So this is how mathematicians think. All right, so even something like, oh, it's not datum, it's not index, it's not a measure, it's an operator, it acts on things. Even numbers can be treated in that way. Okay, it's extremely powerful. So this is what I propose that we do conceptually, right? To think about surfaces, or any object at all, any object. This is a way to resolve, I think, the triple O and all this
other stuff. That's just so much better than triple O. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Don't need that, right? Yeah. We don't lose objects. They still have a purpose, but they're active. They're processually active.
Right.
So we shift, and now the cool thing in terms of, again, thinking more philosophically rather than mathematically, is the following. Say, here's an example. Suppose we have some type of operator acting on some class of things we call fields in this case, all right? So we can say, is it representative, okay? For every kind of action on vector fields, is there any surface that does the job? All right, that opens up the question of, well, if we then, don't worry about language too much. So here's the thing, suppose I have some activity, some way of making measurements on the space of all fields, all right? Turns out they have some nice properties, like they're linear, like if I double the field, I get double the value, let's say. Okay, stuff like that. Then the question is there a nice operator, like a surface rather, that has the same effect as this procedure that I've been describing to you? This is a typical mathematician's move. Typical. And it's very powerful, it's very deep what I just said in terms of mathematical procedure. Because what happens is, this way allows us to extend the notion, the familiar notion of surface, to a much more general class of objects. What objects I think have this kind of effect on the field. Okay? This was done in the 1950s and 60s in mathematics, in what's called geometric measure theory, which allowed people to extend mathematics to extend from the familiar notion of surface to really wild sense, like a cloud of dust. If you take a cloud of dust and just scan it to the air, you can ask, well, what's the flux of the electric field through those little dots in the air? You know? And if you can have some nice properties, I mean, if I double the flux, do I get double the number? Well, I think you would, because you have dust in the air, and here's a bunch of air flowing, wind passing that little particle of dust. If you double the wind, you double the force, right? I'm just using heuristic here. So actually, you're able to handle much more, we can enlarge the ontology, that's it. We can enlarge the ontology of what constitutes a surface using this indirect way of definition, by its effect, not by what it is.
Yeah.
And this begins to sound familiar from philosophy.
Yeah. This is, a, this is right. A lot of how systems biologists actually work with thinking about service.
Okay. The last thing I'll conclude with is a few quotes from, this is from the UCHRI, the University of California Humanities Research Institute, with Goldberg, I think is the name.
Yeah.
And my friend Kavita Philip at UC Irvine. So UC Irvine has a center for, had a center for critical theory, I think. From Kavita, I got this little manifesto a few years ago about poor theory. And this is, for me, interesting as a source of heuristics for how to proceed in ontogenesis group. Okay. And I don't need you to look at this, I'll just read it to you.
Okay.
I'll finish with it. Okay, can I just finish? So I'll give it to you on a different page, so I won't go back to that. Okay, this poor theory I'll send it to you. So I'll just read from, like, to close, I'll read something from how I think about mathematics could be used in this process. I think of mathematics adding Zhuangzi, but without Pythagoras. Okay. So I'm trying to discover and mix together mathematics as materials that are adequate to life, because mathematics has a peculiar power to intertwine the imaginary and the actual. It could be sharply different sorts of poetic symbolic matter, continuous topological dynamics, geometric measure theory, or even fancy stuff like non-commutative algebra, italic cohomology, or sheaf theory. But I choose to start with the simplest symbolic substances that respect the life world's continuous dynamism, change, temporality, infinite transformation, ontogenesis, superposability, continuity, density, and value. And substances that are free of, or at least agnostic with respect to measure, metric, counting, finitude, formal logic, linguistics, digitality, computability. In short, the formal structures that would put a cage over all the life world. Simplicity here is not a requirement of the theory, in other words, no Occam's razor, okay? Merely an acknowledgement that I do not understand enough about the life world to bring out the fancier stuff yet, of which there's so much more available. The fundamental difference in my approach is to use mathematics as substance in a workmanlike way, patching here and there to see what values ensue, okay, as a trellis for play, rather than a carapace, but always considering whether the poetic material accommodates transfinite, incommensurable, imminent passion. Totalizing carapace is like category theory, as adopted by Badiou, or Wolfram's computational equivalence principle, which at the bottom is a transcendental atomic metaphysics founded on making counting sacred, could hammer us into a very sparse ontology. And to a hammer, everything is a nail. Mm-hmm. So why mathematics? Mathematics is conventionally cast as the quintessence of certainty, which is equated with a dry rigidity. It has, however, the advantage of being a mode of articulation that escapes and exceeds the linguistic, a mode of argumentation and disquisition that escapes the legal and the political, and a mode of measurement that escapes the naive notions of sense and sense data. Then, what value lies in looking to mathematics? Stiglitz wrote about Whitehead, and described this already, how Whitehead thinks of mathematics as abstract forms and Deleuzians as abstract, that lure, but they're not generalizations. They're not generalizations, okay? They're not abstractions from something more concrete, okay? So in such passages, Stengers has described an essential feature of the pleasure and consolation of doing mathematics, which is the constant reaching via a rigorous imaginary beyond the actual and beyond matters of fact. Mathematics hitched to a utility can be as rigid and asphyxiating as any schema. But mathematics, as Stiglitz recognized in the practice of mathematicians in their own terms, okay, is indeed, not as scientists, in their own terms, is indeed a performative art, and it is in this poetic and poetic mode that I will articulate some of these arguments. Okay. So I'm doing all this as an exercise in philosophy in the mode of art, trusting that it can be done, philosophy as a mode of art, or in the mode of art, that it matters not only what we say or do, but how we say or do it. I'm wagering that both truth effects and ethical aesthetic passions can be accommodated in the same breath, the way that mathematicians construct truths. However, mathematicians are not scientists because their theorems do not claim anything about the real world. Therefore, they do not write under the sign of empirical truth. Mathematicians prove theorems, true or false, within propositional systems that they themselves construct. Therefore, their constructions are works of imagination, writing neither under the sign of truth nor of fiction. Mathematicians create truths via imaginative processes that can be regarded as poetic processes.
Okay. Could you, kind of going back to the beginning of your remarks, could you, I want to hear you say more about speech, the relation. I guess in a way, I'd like to hear a kind of a greater differentiation of speech over here and sound in a sound field over here. But another term I'd like to introduce to think about, because this is all, as you said, for you, this is within the context, finally, of something called the political and the relationship between the political and the ethical. And so one term to think about, I think, between speech and sound is voice. And what I'm thinking of a lot of different things here, but leaving the kind of whole political, you know, history of political philosophy aside about this, voice seems to me an important, one of those important other terms to introduce, precisely because voice, I'm thinking about, you know, the disagreement that Stanley Cavell had with Derrida, you know, as Cavell said, you know, well, you know, voice for Derrida is just kind of too quickly and too automatically a dirty word for the metaphysics of presence. And I think Cavell is right about that, and I think Derrida complicated that later. But the reason I raise it is that voice is often thought of not as an intentional denotative act, but as a kind of bearing.
Bearing, yeah.
You know, and a kind of posture almost in a way.
Yeah.
That is interestingly kind of in between denotative speech and sound.
Yep.
Right.
It's very nice.
And then you know, you get into really interesting stuff about the voices of non-humans.
Yes.
Very nice. Echolocation.
Yeah, and all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, so could you just, because this for me this bears very directly on a rethinking of the fact that, you know, we actually kind of don't know what the political. And it bears upon a rethinking of the political and the ethical too.
Okay, it's wonderful. I think music can be helpful here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one thing I've always wondered is why is it that an academic conference only one speaker speaks at a time?
Right. Well,
obviously, because two people speak at a time is confusing, right? It's rude and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but in music, we have people singing concurrently all the time. So what is it that makes that possible and interesting and desirable, all that kind of thing? So this is an indirect response to what you're saying, because I haven't thought about it now, except in this moment about singing. Because it seems to me that singing and multiple voice singing is the way to begin to approach what you're asking. Because there we have something to look to. And we have a set of practices in every nation, every cultural setting, for centuries and centuries, we have different ways of voicing, of composing for voices, and people sing ad hoc, etc., and to clash or not clash, etc., to join in, to stop. I think it's very, very rich. I think we can explore your question maybe in that context. And then the next question would be how to bring it to the non-musical setting, you know? How does it, when we start to dial down the singing part of it, you know?
Well, that's why I think where Alvin Lucier's work is so interesting, because he goes from the musical to the sonic.
Yes.
And I think that transition, and actually he's suspicious of music because of the way it brings in meaning.
Yes. That's how sound gardens are interesting now. In the areas that I work in, there's always this interest in sound art, right, or sound design. Because that's right in the middle between, like, human voice with musical structure all the way to non-human sounds,
right?
And there's a lot of control that we have to that.
Right.
And you can bring back in the notion of voicing that you're suggesting. How do we voice, or how do we make instruments that voice aspects of the world that are not human? Right? So we're explicitly thinking about some of those questions.
Right. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, this kind of, the stakes around troubling and being kind of permanently uncertain about the relationship between sound, voice, and speech as a seriously kind of ethical matter, you know. So I was thinking of this artist I've written about, whose work I mentioned yesterday, this guy Michael Pestel, who did this big installation piece on the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon. But he's trained as a composer and a musician, and he's done a lot of improvisational work with Anthony Braxton and stuff. But, you know, he's got, and a lot of people have done this kind of work, you know, he went into an aviary with a whole battery of like woodwind instruments and just kind of went around in the aviary, just kind of stretched out on his back and just started sort of, you know, just trying to elicit, you know, a kind of a conversation with all these different kinds of birds. And then just what evolves from that, you know, is kind of one of those moments where you sort of start with a form of code, a form of notation, etc., and even how that's built into the physicality of the instrument that you're playing and the history of that instrument. And then it kind of opens on to, you know, it opens on to another space.
Yep.
That's in some way like a deeply ethical
space.
It's like, you know, you talk to Michael, he's like, no, the birds, like, we're drawn deep into this third thing. Mm-hmm. You know, this neither me or the bird. And the technology makes it possible.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Most of our ethics is still the billiard ball world. And what you're talking about is wave dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's wave dynamics.
Well, yeah. Bird behavior, right? Bird song behavior.
Yeah.
So there's also that coming in together with the
history performance. I mean, the reason I'm just getting into all this is I know that for you, you know, the play is serious play at the end of the day, because it feeds into these kinds of, you know, kind of political and ethical questions.
Yeah.
And that's the frame within which I'm...
So let me try to, instead of pointing somewhere else, just close with this to respond more directly to you. I could count for one. It was Michel Serres saying, we don't understand, how can we talk about multiplicity when we don't even understand the one, right? And I say, well...
No, you don't even understand what?
The one. What does it mean to say, I count, or I vote, right? That this person counts, this person doesn't count, in the sense of, you know, this is one vote, this is another vote, this is a citizen. So I'm really, okay. So maybe one way to go is maybe again it's a discrete versus potential again. Maybe before we get to the discrete, that is, I count, the one, right?
Yeah.
Maybe this is where voice can come in, is how does one begin to speak, right? It's not a just say, I'm speaking or not speaking. If we think about expression, or listen to letters again, you know, or we think about birds singing versus what. So I think maybe one way to think about this is not so much it's the precursor to the voice, is the instrument, right? Voicing. What are our practices we need to construct such that those that were voiceless now become audible to us as voices?
Yeah.
Is that's the really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could be as simple as a bag of air and go like this in terms of a bagpipe, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, what's really I took a bunch of students to the Faroe Islands, and which is a fascinating place to look at this type of issue. Because of the relationship between national politics versus oral and written note systems, because they basically had an oral tradition in the Faroe Islands. And the political state was about writing, because it was all Danish. And so they had to develop an orthography later on. But because of that, they claim they have certain types of relationships with the world through their musical, the way they work with the music, that they may not have had other ways through their textual relationships.
Right. I mean, in the deep background for me with this is, and this is kind of coming out of my interest in non-human creatures and all that stuff, but, you know, the locus classicus for Paul, I mean, Aristotle says, look, alone among all the gregarious animals, and this is word gregarious, which means noisemaking, basically, if in the translation, you know, are human beings who are capable of meaningful speech, right? But we now know from science and life sciences, we now know that all sorts of non-human creatures engage in meaningful speech. And yet, where that leads in Aristotle and in political philosophy generally is that politics is about meaningful speech as a mode of reciprocal relations, which are political because they are artificial. Precisely because they are artificial.
Yeah.
And so everything, there's a connection, a bundling between, you know, non-artificiality, which is to say some kind of ontological substrate that you're interested in here, and the question of speech and non-human life that fundamentally reshapes the domain of the ethical and the political in ways that we don't really have a way to.
Yeah.
And this and the reciprocity, which was never kind of right anyway, but reciprocity is just completely impoverished way of thinking about this more robust sense of, you could call it community, you could call it being with, I mean, there are different ways you could talk about it, but this little note of speech, voice, sound is a place to...
It's
a place where all this can kind of be raised without being just utterly pedantic about it.
Yeah,
I think that's a really fascinating place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really great idea.
Thank you. Wow. Thanks to all of you.
Well, there's a lot of room to move around in.
Well, good. Can't you live?
Okay, so it took a lot of time and energy. So
we should go eat, I think.
Yeah? Okay.
Because you have a call at 2.
At 2.
Yeah, we should
do that. Yeah.
And then we'll continue.